We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're talking with Dr. Julian Womble about Harry Potter and identity. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry at Ohio Dominican University, where I also teach in our humanities program. And I have also edited a few scholarly anthologies with Katie and also with Amy H. Sturgis.
Yes, Emily and I have occasionally been the editor and also the edited in these volumes.
Yes, I like that dynamic of our relationship where we can just kind of go back and forth, just trade hats a little bit. And it's very good. It's very collaborative.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And rewarding, right?
Yeah, indeed.
So today we are talking with someone who I think successfully straddles both the fan and academic Harry Potter communities. And so, Emily, for our introductory question, I wondered where you feel like you are there. Do you think your academic approach to pop culture works, like Harry Potter, like Star Wars, and so on? Do you think that that academic approach crosses over to the fandom? We have these academic approaches to pop culture, and sometimes academic communities are resistant to them, the pop culture part, and sometimes the pop culture or fan communities are resistant to some of the academic part. And I wondered, where do you think, have you achieved a good balance? Do you feel like it's respected on both sides, fandom and academia? What do you think about the kind of bridging those two worlds?
That's a really interesting question for me, particularly because as someone who is, as my friend Miriam Abbott says, who is master's prepared, and is in academia rather than PhD, one would think that I'm kind of aiming things more at a popular audience. And I think a lot of times I do, but I think part of that might be my writing style is very, I try to be very accessible with my writing style, but
that's what we call good writing, Emily.
Oh.
I could see Julian is also.
I appreciate that. I do always want it to be comprehensible to the kind of basic reader. But I don't actually seek out sort of fan interpretation. And I don't often put a lot of store by it. Once in a while, I hear something that I really like. And, sometimes I'll cite that. So I feel like my work tends to be more academic. But I guess I do have a blog, and I do try to do more kind of accessible sort of public scholarship sort of accessible. But I can't write without footnotes. Is that an indicator? Is that an indicator? I can't write something that doesn't have footnotes in it.
That's pretty academic there, Emily.
I know.
That's not super accessible, although I love footnotes. I feel like it's a little secret conversation that you have with your reader.
It totally is.
But what I hear you saying is that you are trying to be, as you say, like a public scholar. You want scholarship to be accessible, but that you're not necessarily interested in engaging with the fandom directly.
Yeah, sorry, fandom. I love you. I'm part of you. I am. And that's the thing, is that I am part of the fandom. Like, I shouldn't say I started as fandom. I love to love this stuff. Like, somebody was complaining that they were not interested in The Mandalorian and Grogu that's coming out in May. And I was like, what? Who are you? Are you a fan? Like, I just love to love this stuff. I just want to love it, you know. But then I put on a different hat, when I'm thinking about it critically. And then the academic stuff comes out, Katie, what about you? Because your stuff is very academic.
I'm a historian, so I'm not even like a literary scholar. And Julian, our guest today, is political science. So, we're even a little on the outs in terms of what a lot of Harry Potter scholarship is. But I did not always have a lot of success in publishing in academic history. I thought it was a kind of tough place to publish. And I actually had some of my best success in like looking at historical themes in pop culture, and I started in Harry Potter, but then it allowed me to do all kinds of other things, and I have been able to be really productive and scholarly in a number of areas that were not like what my dissertation research was, because I got into it through the Harry Potter world. And so I really value that. I think there are people who I gave somebody my sabbatical review who was an interim provost. And in it, it was, I had my Connie Willis, you know, sci-fi stuff.
Love Connie
and
Willis.
Then I had the Star Wars essay, and then I had some Harry Potter stuff. And the guy responded, "You must be super fun at cocktail parties." It was kind of a compliment, but also like, that's not the, you know, in an academic setting. I was like, is that a dig? But I didn't care. Like, I don't
right. You know, it's only a dig if you take it as a dig. So
I think I'm fortunate enough that I don't really have to care. And I'm at a small institution where they're happy for you to be engaged in any way. And especially if it can inform your teaching and make your subject more accessible to students. It's actually, my colleagues have been great about it and really, you know, really respect it. I occasionally, you know, would get a little eyebrow, but I don't care about that. So
I feel like the eyebrows are just less and less these days.
Yeah,
and,
I think
and
so too.
Not to get us too far away from our this is a heck of a cold open. I just was invited to speak at a conference last weekend at Loyola, and they wanted me to talk about using science fiction in the classroom, especially in the Catholic tradition, teaching, you know, humanities from a Catholic perspective. And people were fascinated. And I told the organizer afterwards, I was like, this is just like so amazing when I look back 20 years ago at just dipping my toe in this water.
Yeah.
And the eyebrow, like you said, the eyebrow that you would get and the assumption that, you know, you're fun at cocktail parties, but maybe that's it, you know. I'm so impressed by the interest, because I think people want to do what works for our students. They're realizing that they can't just keep, we can't just keep handing them Ulysses.
Yeah. Right.
They've become interested. Students have changed so radically in 20 years that they've become open to these new ideas, which I absolutely love. I don't know. Yeah. Is that still kind of in the vein
of your
question?
That's right. Giving students access points and all of that. I think that's really, really crucial. And as I mentioned, today we are being joined on the podcast by, I think, someone who does seem to bridge these two worlds, academic and fandom, with distinction. And that is Dr. Julian Womble. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. He's won multiple awards for his scholarship, including the Political Science Association's Best Dissertation Award for Race and Ethnic Politics in 2019 and the Distinguished Scholar Award in Political Psychology in 2022. His book, titled We Choose You, How Black Voters Decide Which Candidates to Support, was published by Cambridge University Press just last year in 2025. In addition to this scholarship and the university courses he teaches on public opinion and political psychology, as well as contemporary race relations in the U.S., he also teaches a course called Harry Potter and Social Identity. He has become incredibly popular in the Harry Potter fandom for his social media posts, particularly about his Potter classroom topics, and he hosts a Harry Potter podcast called Critical Magic Theory, whose motto is Be Critical, Stay Magical. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Thank you both so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
That is just a great podcast subtitle.
I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Or motto,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's I love it because I think it's succinct, it's catchy, and it sums up what I hope is kind of imbued in each episode, is the idea of magic doesn't have to be something that only exist without kind of critical thinking. And that's kind of a mindset that I tend to have about a lot of things, but particularly when it comes to Harry Potter.
Well, and also that deep analysis and deep understanding of these texts doesn't evacuate them of the fun and the magic and the things that people enjoy about them. I think sometimes I'll go off on something with a student and they'll be like, well, you just ruined it for me, so...
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I open up every episode by saying loving something doesn't mean we can't be critical of it.
Right.
And I think that there's a way that I have come to understand that particular dynamic, because part of when I first started posting on social media, I would get all of these comments being like, do you even like Harry Potter? which I think is really fascinating because it suggests that somehow asking questions and thinking more deeply is indicative of not liking it. And I always say to them, do you think I would spend this much time thinking this hard about something that I didn't like when it would just be easier to not engage at all? And so the fact that I am engaging this way is for me such an indication of how much I do love this world, this universe, and all the things in it. And that's how I show my love, is by kind of really tearing it apart and seeing what's going on underneath.
That attitude is also, you know, what helps to bridge, you know, the academic world, which is often seen as critical, and the fan world, where you really are there for the magic of it. And I agree with you. Like, I don't think you have to, you know, only do one or the other. One of the great things is to see, you know, it's not even like seeing how it works, like how the magic works, but like, to me, it almost makes it more magical.
Agreed.
Yeah. Agreed. So, Julian, tell us, when did you first encounter the Harry Potter stories? And when did you decide that they were worthy of that critical perspective?
I started reading Harry Potter when I was like 10 years old. And they were at the Scholastic Book Fair. And I picked up Prisoner of Azkaban first, because only the first three had come out. I think Prisoner of Azkaban had just come out, so it was very prominent. And I bought it, started reading it, realized that I was two books ahead of where I needed to be, went back the next day, bought the first one, read Sorcerer's Stone in the night. Like, I just read it all at once, then went back to the book fair and bought the second one. My mom was paying for all of this, so money wasn't real, and I was living it up on her dime.
and their books, so she was happy too.
Exactly. And there was a lot of leveraging of like, well, you want me reading. And so I read... and so that was my introduction. And so then from elementary school all the way through high school, I was completely obsessed. And, the seventh book came out the summer I graduated from high school. So my entire trajectory with Emmett Hogwarts was like from the very early, I think I was 10 or 11 when it started, and I was 18 when it ended. And so the entirety of the vast majority of my childhood, adolescence, teenage years was kind of bookmarked with Harry Potter. And then when I got to graduate school, obviously I went into political science, and then it wasn't until much later, I think I was towards the end of my graduate school time, and I would listen to Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And I would listen to that quite a bit. Until I started writing my dissertation, and then I was like, this is too big brain. I can't do it. My brain is going to explode. So I took some time off, but my brain was always working with the idea of what that podcast did so well, which is like really just diving in and thinking through a lot of the kind of connections that we can make to the world that we live in. And I was reading, or I was listening to an audiobook. I think it might have been either Deathly Hallows or Half-Blood Prince. And I was mowing the lawn, and I got to a point, I can't remember exactly what, but I kept thinking, why doesn't Voldemort just promote purebloods having more babies? Like, why is the idea of pureblood supremacist ideology, like, and the pureblood kind of mania, why is it so focused on Muggleborns, when they have nothing to do with anything that has anything to do with like the prominence and the positionality of purebloods? And I thought, oh, wow, because it actually has nothing to do with kind of pro pureblood beliefs. It's all anti-Muggleborn, right? And so that the way that his mind was working, it was all supposed to, it was presented in a pro group way, but it was actually anti-group. And I thought, wouldn't that be cool to teach a class on like group politics, thinking about how we understand the mentality behind this idea, right? About you know, how do we understand kind of supremacist ideology that tends to be couched in terms of being pro something, when actually the undercurrent is very anti-outgroup. And so I started noodling with that, and then in the halcyon days of Twitter, I kind of pitched it a little bit on the internet to see kind of what people would take away. And it kind of went crazy and people had lots of things to say. And I thought, okay, I can do this. And then when I got to GW, I decided that I was going to do it and just teach this class. And yeah, that was how I got there.
I love that. You know, so my first Harry Potter paper was about house elves and feminism. And I came up with that idea while listening to the book on tape and doing the dishes.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is like unliberated housewives in the 1950s. So so that was the starting point. So it's funny how it can kind of work on you that way. Like you say, kind of noodling around with an idea and then testing it out. And I'm, you know, I think that's great that thinking, just like we were saying in our intro, like that it's a great way to teach students about something. One of the things that I think is good is like, when you teach them about it in the wizarding world, they don't bring necessarily their own party politics into something. And so they can maybe think a little more clearly about it. Yeah. Do you find that that's true?
I do. And that's the point of the class is basically that one of my students, the first semester that I taught this class, he said, oh, you use Harry Potter as a Trojan horse. And I thought, I love that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to steal that. And I will cite him by calling him a student of mine. But yeah, and so the goal is really to kind of get them thinking about these things that we are societally invited to not think about. Mm-hmm. And because it's made to feel easier to not think about these things. And so, you know, and there's a lot of internal things that people have to navigate as we think about, especially identity-based things. And so if we can talk about house elves or, you know, a pure blood supremacy or, you know, any of these other kinds of dynamics at work. And then all of their assignments are meant to then teach a lesson to someone else using Harry Potter as the kind of entry point and then bringing in scholastic work and articles and books to build the bridge between what's the real world and Harry Potter. And so to kind of get them to build the vocabulary and also understand that you can, like, there are ways that you can teach people that is accessible and doesn't have to necessarily come from an outrageously kind of emotional personal space, but that can still be outrageously effective. And so that's kind of the goal. And I do find that it works very well. And I've had students write some incredible papers using Harry Potter in ways that I never thought. And that I remember the first paper I had a student write, well, she wrote her final paper on prison abolition, using Sirius Black as a kind of case study and like his arrested development and the all of the legal issues within the wizarding world. And she built out this project. And I remember reading it and being like, wow, maybe this class, which was really just an excuse to get my institution to pay me to read Harry Potter, is actually doing something real. And, you know, that's the goal of any instructor, is to kind of feel like tangibly that there's something that's effective happening. And it's been really, really great to kind of see how students take it, and they really do take it on and try their hand at really diving in and thinking about the bridge between our own lives and those kind of displayed and illustrated in the books. The thing about Harry Potter that's so fascinating is that it ends the way that it begins, in that Voldemort is vanquished, Harry is there, and the world is almost exactly the same. Like, there's so little that's actually structurally shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And I often kind of highlight the reality of how part of the reason why that's the case is because the wizarding world puts all the bad stuff into Voldemort, so that when he goes, we're like, well, we did it. I'm having this conversation with my students, and I had a student that said to me, but what if it did change and we just don't recognize it? And I was like, you know, very dubious. And I'm like, oh, well, I think you missed the point. And she's like, it's not impossible. And she says, you know, there's no way that you go through something like the Battle of Hogwarts and not walk away recognizing the need for change. And we went back and forth about, you know, is it a recognition of the need to kind of change the structure in which the wizarding world operates? Because at the root of it, that's kind of the problem. But I loved that moment because I very rarely walk away from these books with a but what if? Dot 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 question mark. And the fact that she invoked that, I just loved the idea of it. Another moment or other moments that I often when we were reading, we read the latter four books. So when
those
we
are
were
the
reading,
most political ones, so
exactly,
I totally understand
exactly.
That.
Exactly. And so when we get to Half-Blood Prince at the end, I often will tell my class that they're jurors and their job is to try the case of Draco Malfoy.
I love
and
that.
How do we understand the role that he plays? And you know, a lot of people in the fandom, and we see this, you know, in conversations, we see it in fanfic, we see it kind of across the space of really blaming Lucius and Narcissa for a lot of what Draco does. And one of the questions that I often ask is, at what point do we start to hold people accountable for their actions? And with the recognition that those individuals who are privileged tend to have that timeline pushed way back. And so I love that moment because it gets very contentious, because people are often, you know, well, it's his parents' fault that he turned out this way. And I often counter that by saying yes, but then we also see moments, say in Deathly Hallows, where Draco's very aware of what he's doing. He makes meaningful decisions, and we don't attribute those things to his parents. So how is it that only the more noble things get attributed to him, but all of the bad things come from his socialization? And I also bring up the point, and this is a bit contentious, that I'm like, but he and Ron were socialized in very similar ways outside of blood supremacy. And we see those things kind of crop up here and there, but we are not as generous in our forgiving of Ron when he slips up and like says some things that are not as, you know, kind or that are, you know, socially problematic. And we have a very clear like belief structure about the fact that Ron's parents loved him and he should know better, but Draco's doesn't. And so I love those moments because I think it invites a much larger conversation about how we understand socialization and how we understand, you know, in our own society, we see the idea of children being tried as adults. And how do we understand when those things are reasonable? Who are the people who we perceive as being deserving of that treatment, and the idea and the politicization of childhood, right? And when childhood gets to exist and for whom, and when it doesn't and under what circumstances. And so we get to kind of dive into all of that in a way that I find to be so much fun.
Yeah, and you can get them thinking and talking about it with this character that they all have in common, like they've read it, and yet it's a little bit to the side of anything that would be super personal. So
yeah.
I love how human you are in your podcast, and you take characters and you try to really understand them, which I think is so important, and that I especially am interested in all the Draco stuff. But when you were talking, it occurred to me, you know, Draco also has an ally in Snape who is definitely in Death Eater camps, and he's somebody that he could be drawing from and relying on. And Snape is inviting confidences and really trying to take burdens from Draco, and Draco is not taking that opportunity. And, you know, I think it's important to think about that role, you know, the role that this other adult plays when, you know, Harry has a lot of stuff going on, and he does try to, you know, he finds other adults to model and, you know, in some ways that, you know, help him to make different kinds of choices. And I think Draco could have had some different choices there in book six.
Oh, absolutely. I think that Draco makes the decision, a lot of the decisions, but it's all born out of the belief that if victorious, he can take all the credit, which is a very kind of like Lucius mentality, right? And I also think that he has been like made to believe by Voldemort that if you don't do this, it's over for everybody, right? And I think that's a lot of pressure to place on him. And I do think it is fascinating because we can all accept the fact that, yes, obviously his socialization, his parents play a big part in the way that he understands the world. But Lucius has much more of a kind of he never, ever, ever calls anyone a slur outside. Like, he does it all the time when they are, you know, at home, I'm sure. And even when they're in Madame Malkin's shop, Draco and Narcissa, she doesn't say any, like, she's very kind of demure in her approach to discussing Hermione, right? But Draco is like, I don't care. I'm calling everybody whatever I feel. And he just has this kind of, there's a naivete to it. Mm-hmm. But also there's a sense of invincibility that I think is both socialized, but also it's like he's a teenager.
Yeah, no, it's insecurity. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I find that dynamic to be so fascinating, because even Lucius is like, you need to calm down. Like, you need to pull it back, because we, in public, we don't act like this. And Draco is just like, I don't care. It doesn't matter. And I love that dynamic at work.
Yeah. I mean, it's naivety on his part. Truly. As well to not understand that what happens in the world of his little family is not, you know, that world that's outside, that
yeah.
people are going to disagree. People are going to, you know, it's going to get confrontational, you know.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And that the whole point of why Lucius lied about being in league with Voldemort after the first Wizarding War was so that they could continue to live a comfortable life. And it is incumbent upon Draco to recognize that for the sake of his own livelihood. And we see the struggle that he then has in Half-Blood Prince once Lucius has been arrested and put into Azkaban, and now he and Narcissa are in this really dubious social position, and neither of them really know what to do about it, because they're not used to having to navigate a social politic where everyone knows who they truly are and what they're really about.
They're people who like to keep as many options as possible open to them.
Exactly.
You know, which
exactly.
is such a Slytherin trait, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I
mean,
yeah.
And I mean, and it doesn't have to be bad, you know?
No.
It doesn't have to be a
I'm
bad
a Slytherin,
thing. It's just,
and I yeah. And I absolutely agree that you want to make sure that, like, there is a way that there's an exit strategy. And Lucius always had one. I mean, one of my favorite moments with Lucius is when he is in the graveyard in Goblet of Fire, and Voldemort's like, you are a snake. And Lucius is like, am I?
Yeah.
Or am I just, like, super loyal and you just, like, kind of missed the point? I mean, and he's so good at just being like, no, no, no. It wasn't me. It was them. And who am I? Like, who am I? If I hadn't have been out of jail, there are lots of things that really couldn't have worked for you. So in some ways, you're welcome. Like, he's just, he's a used car salesman in a way yeah. that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
You know, sort of thinking about that as a historian, like, the people who I'm always fascinated by are the people who make it through, like, every phase of a revolution.
Yes. Yes.
Like, I think of Jacques-Louis David in the French Revolution, who's the painter for every phase, all the way through Napoleon. And I think, how did that guy do it? And yeah. Who else? Is it Abbé Sieyès makes it all the way through? And you think, like, how did these guys not get guillotined? And there's a little Lucius quality mm-hmm. there. Like, I can be whatever needs to happen at this moment.
Exactly.
Like, Voldemort's in. Okay, this is where we're going. He's out. Oh, now I'm going to do this thing. It looks yeah. like he's coming back. Oh, how do I straddle this?
Yeah. And I think that part of what happens with Lucius is that in Order of the Phoenix, he is forced to choose a side he's never had to choose before. And I think that is his biggest downfall, because he always bets on the winning horse. And at that moment, you don't know who's going to win. And I think that's also why he wanted the prophecy so bad, not just for Voldemort, but because he's like, which horse am I going to back?
Ooh.
And he, mm-hmm. in that moment, when all this is going on, he has no idea. And I think it really, really messes with the strategy that has been a winning one for him. And his money can't get him out of it. His, like, you know, silver tongue can't get him out of it. And so he pays the price and ends up in Azkaban. And even when he comes back, is still being punished in Deathly Hallows,
yeah,
right? Loses his wand, and they're taking over his house. And I think some of what we see Voldemort, you know, leverage against Lucius is absolute jealousy. Like, he's just envious of Lucius's ability to do all of that, to be able to kind of ebb and flow and move and change. But I also think that it's the price that Lucius pays for being someone who tries to straddle in a way that simply you can't, when you are a henchman to, mm-hmm. to Voldemort. It just doesn't work.
You've talked some about Hermione and identity and the multiple identities that she bears with her. Yeah, and so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about like how you talk to students about her situation and how that maybe opens up their way of thinking about maybe their own intersectional identities.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we were talking about this earlier, Emily, about like Hermione and the way that we as readers are kind of guided to see her as this kind of North Star, right? She knows all the magical things. She is outrageously emotionally adept. Like she just has a way of navigating the world in a way that I think a lot of readers, especially young readers, and especially like a lot of young girls will see her and say like, queen. And I think that I totally get it. But I also think that what tends to happen for Hermione is because she is muggle-born and we see her persecuted on the grounds of her being muggle-born by Draco Malfoy and all of the other pureblood supremacy people, that we tend to overlook a lot of the privileges that she does actually have. And I think some of this is the societal belief that if you are marginalized, you can't be privileged. And that, you know, and I think that there's a world in which like that is a really dangerous fallacy because it means then you can't recognize the damage that you may or may not cause because of the privileged position that you are in. And I think, you know, we see Hermione as a muggle born. And, you know, one of the things that I often think about and talk to my students about a lot is her relationship with house elves and the reality that there is this very strong desire to liberate them, which we as readers completely understand because slavery is bad and we recognize that as being true. However, it becomes very complicated because Hermione never really talks to the house elves before she's made the decision to do this. She doesn't account for most of what it is that they are saying to her. And when they do say it, she says something along the lines of, well, they're all brainwashed and don't know better. So she's coming
false from consciousness.
Yeah, this place of like, well, they don't know better. And I inherently, me, a muggle-born person who just found out about this entire population of people T-minus 3 seconds ago, I've read so little about it because the school library doesn't have anything for us to even read about. But I know what's best for you. And you have to give me deference because I hold a wand and a magical person. But I'm not acknowledging that reality.
And right. Also, I'm 13 and you're like 106.
Exactly. And I never want to take away from the motivation for what she's doing. I think it's so important. Right. And I understand that. But I also do think that there is a bit of like a white saviorism thing happening here that we have to call out because we don't want to replicate this behavior. And it's fascinating. When Harry frees Dobby at the end of Chamber of Secrets, Dobby is unemployed and unhoused for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
begging.
Trying to get. And we as readers never think about that part, right? Like he gets freed, which is great, but then what?
Mm-hmm.
And that part is the hard part because it's like, you know, how do we understand the way the logistics should work? And so, and we are not invited to think about any of that other than the fact that Harry did a good thing, which is great. And again, it is a good thing, but now Dobby is paying the price. And then when you juxtapose that with the reality that once Hermione starts knitting these hats and leaving them just everywhere in the Gryffindor common room, it is Dobby who is basically charged with cleaning the entirety of Gryffindor Tower.
Right.
And he's freed. So, so it's like, how do we reconcile the idea that he is paying the price as a liberated elf, the very thing that you are trying to get the other people to do, and he is paying the price, and you are not paying attention enough to recognize that as being the case, because all you're invested in is the feeling of what it means to free these elves and not thinking about what it means when they actually are freed and what structural hurdles and confines exist for them upon actually being liberated. And I don't think you really even know what freeing them actually entails because you're not their master. And so I think that, you know, Hermione is an amazing character, but I often say like she's not above reproach, and that there are things that she does, and House Elves is just one of them. My listeners, I always joke because I'm like, Hermione, she gets up to some stuff, and we all read it as readers, and we're like, yeah, well, that was justified. She should have put that grown lady in a jar that she couldn't break out of. She should have maimed Marietta for the rest of her life.
I know,
because she decided to not have consent when they signed that form. Her brilliance justifies a lot of her behavior in a way that I'm like, y'all, we have to be very careful about what we sign on to.
Yeah.
But I also think that one of the beautiful complexities about Hermione is that she contains all of that. And there's a way that we can still kind of say, hey, I think Ron had it right when he said, you're brilliant, scary.
Yeah, right.
But brilliant. And then like, yeah, that's right. And
yeah, and don't you think she starts pretty rigid, and then you can see her developing over time with some of these attitudes, and I'm not going to say always in a great direction, because I think she's also coming into her own power.
Yeah,
at the same time as she's maturing, but you can at least see that development in a complicated way. That's one of the things that I like is about Harry Potter is that you have some really complicated heroic figures.
She set Snape on fire.
Yeah.
And I never think about it as like an unhinged thing to do, but I'm like, of all the things that you needed to do, you said flames.
just his hem. Well, like, yeah, try having your hem set on fire.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, if all he had to do was break eye contact, you could have like jumped out in front of him. You could have recourse that it's flames. You could have pushed him, honestly. Like, there are so many things that could have been done,
nope,
and your mind went straight to fire. Okay.
Oh my gosh. Julian, do you find students making a lot of current day comparisons? You talked about your student who got into prison reform. And Emily and I heard a great paper about that at the Harry Potter Academic Conference.
Amazing. So
we're hoping that we'll have a little podcast about prison reform and stuff that's fascinating when you actually look deeply at it. But I wonder if the Harry Potter realm gives some, you know, freedom for those kinds of current day references.
I find that it does. And in fact, I mean, they have to. That's the assignment. So they kind of have to do it, which is great. But yeah, I mean, I remember one student wrote a paper on coup d'etats and how do we understand the kind of origins of coups. And they kind of used their final project. They have to kind of find a through line across the latter four books. And what this student did was they looked at Voldemort's return and how it is that he was able to kind of bring himself back to power with the justification. And one of the things that I talk about a lot in class is that the only reason that it works for Voldemort is because the citizenry within the magical world is so drastically ignorant of everything that is not magical.
Right.
And so that when you bring up something and you have a propaganda pamphlet that says muggles and the dangers they pose, it's like, well, because you all have segregated yourselves and have absolutely no idea how anything in the non-magical world works, you are so susceptible to this misinformation campaign because you don't know anything. So that when Voldemort comes and starts kind of taking over, everyone's like, well, isn't it weird that Muggleborns have magic? Like, how did they get magic? How are we supposed to understand that? Maybe we should have a registry because, like, I mean, we kind of need answers, right? Like, we kind of need to know, like, did they steal it? Did they? And so that level of ignorance that we see kind of that's so pervasive in the magical world lends itself to coups because people don't really know better. And you can leverage that ignorance in a way that makes people maybe not lean towards kind of the Death Eater supremacist ideology, but they can lean far enough away from thinking that there's something wrong with it that it doesn't really matter in the end, whether they believe it or not. And I think that was a really interesting paper. So I think they do a great job of bridging the gap.
That's wonderful. And I know that you've also put some of the classroom topics on social media.
Yeah.
And you've gotten a lot of good fan engagement. So what made you decide to engage with the fandom in that way? And what are some of the responses that you've gotten outside the classroom?
Yeah, I decided to do it because I had a lot of millennials who are my age who were like, oh, I would love to take that class. And so when I started teaching it, I thought, okay, it'll be fun to just like take a minute of the class and post it because like my friends and I can then talk about it.
Right.
and so I really just had it in mind that like it'll be for me and the like Potterheads in my life who are wanting to chat about it, but like don't want to pay GW's tuition. And it blew up in a way that I was not at all prepared for. But it's been so fun. And it continues to be a lot of fun. And a lot of the reactions, a lot of people are like, I want to take this class, which is part of the reason why I started the podcast, because I thought like, you don't want to pay that tuition, but we can still have a good time. But then there are also people who, you know, what I have learned about the Harry Potter fandom, because we've been around for a long time. And many of us have grown up in a way that I think we've never actually had to leave Hogwarts. There's always some way to stay, whether it be, you know, just re-listening to the books or fan fiction or whatever. And that we have very strong opinions about things. And so sometimes people get very upset with me on some of the takes that I've had. And I think, and funnily enough, most of them are about Hermione. And most people get very mad when I am like, let's ask ourselves a couple questions about one Miss Hermione Jean Granger. And I get a lot of DMs being like, how could you?
Oh, no.
And how dare you? And do you really think that you're the one who needs to be having this conversation?
Oh, like,
oh yeah, wow. No, people get very mad about it. And which...
Like from a feminist perspective, maybe.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Mm. From some people from a feminist perspective. And I think, and I love it. I absolutely love it because I think, you know, I'm like, yeah, here's this dude talking about like what it is to be a young girl. And I'm like, yeah, I get the skepticism, but I want you to take a moment to just hear the words. Because I promise you, like, I thought that before you thought that. And that's why I posted this on the internet. Because I would like to think that I'm a fairly self-aware person and I'm not just going to be out here trying to mansplain femininity to people. But it's a thing, especially in a video that has gone very viral in a way that I wish it hadn't, but fine. In terms of the questioning of Hermione's relationships with other women and girls in the series, and how it is that we understand and see it at work. And people were very upset. And it was interesting because, and I never followed up because I didn't want to keep the fire burning. But
yeah.
One of the biggest critiques of what I was saying, which was Hermione's relationship with women and girls is very fraught. We don't see her really having a lot of girlfriends, which is, of course, not a necessity. But there are so many moments in the Golden Trio where she is the odd person out and is kind of left in isolation. And we see that in Prisoner of Azkaban when she reports the firebolt. And she is kind of operating from a place of friendlessness. And she's just with Hagrid working on this case. And it strikes me that you share a room with other Gryffindor girls and you don't really have the space to kind of lean on them and the dynamics between all of you is very contentious in a lot of ways. And the response that I got, and I think it is very interesting and probably worth unpacking a little bit more, is, well, girls are terrible. Young girls are just really mean. And so like, and a lot of people in the comments were like, well, I just had a lot of guy friends when I was, and I'm like, but do you see how your critique of what I'm saying is actually leaning into a very patriarchal understanding of a justification that boys are easier and girls are mean and bad. And as if we don't see Ron and Harry engage in that behavior with Hermione for the entirety of the series. Mm-hmm. And so it was really interesting. And I feel very privileged to be able to create a space where people not only feel comfortable disagreeing with me, but disagreeing with me vehemently, call me to task and highlight the fact that like I am a dude and I'm like, you are correct. And I recognize that on that post and on others, whenever I kind of not even push back, but try to explain a little bit more of my thinking on things, people will say, I'm sorry, I just took that very personally because I think of myself as Hermione. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I love that. And I appreciate like that you are recognizing that reality, but let's unpack that for a second.
Right. Yeah.
Let's think about why it is that it feels okay for us to watch her be outrageously antagonistic to some of these women and girls, which isn't to say that they don't deserve it, but she does not keep the same kind of energy for the boys. She punches Draco, and that's about it. All that Ron puts her through, all that even Harry puts her through, and she's there for them. And it's a beautiful friendship, but it's like there is a drastic difference in the way of the treatment that we see. And so I love the conversations that we get to have on social media, and sometimes it can get very spicy. But I love chaos, and so I have no problem being a harbinger of chaos if it means that people have to think about things that they've not thought of before.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the whole educational enterprise, right? And I was thinking about, like, in political science graduate school, I'm sure it's similar to history, maybe even worse than history. Like, seminars are arguments.
Yeah.
And argument is the key of what you're supposed to do. And you argue, but you argue not because, like, to only, like, maintain your own position, but you argue, they argue. And the idea is that through argument, you are coming to something that is more like truth, you know, not totally like in the middle, because sometimes the truth's not in the middle, right? But the argument is the way that you find truth, and that argument is good. And I think a lot of times people are not, and people don't argue well.
I do think that there is a world, there's a way that, you know, there's a comfort that people have. Like, I just finished debating with someone online today about the casting of the TV show and Snape and questions about whether or not it was okay or good that he was cast as a Black man. And I made a video about it and I just reposted it today. And someone said, like, you're missing the point. And, you know, there are lots of reasons why Snape can't be Black. And I said, no character in Harry Potter is white. Not a single one. No one is described as a white person in those books. The only characters that are racialized are Cho Chang, the Patil twins, and the five Black characters in the series. Everyone else lives in a racial limbo, and we just fill in the blank.
We assume whiteness.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, which is a feature of the, you know, racial disparity as well.
Exactly, exactly. And so, and I said, you know, there's nothing in Snape's narrative that suggests that whiteness is a necessity. There's nothing in the narrative of most of the characters, honestly, because I'm like, we have a Blaise Zabini, so we know that we can have a pure blood supremacist Black person that exists in the space. And so even that doesn't require whiteness. And it's so... people will write comments or send me DMs. And I think because I have the followers number that I have, they don't think that I'll respond, but I almost always respond. Some of it is important. And I'm like, and if you feel brave enough to like be in conversation with me, then like, let's have that conversation. And again, it's the beautiful thing about, I think, Harry Potter in ways that I think is different from even other fandoms and other series is that the parallels are so easily drawn. Your assumption of whiteness as a default in these books speaks to something much larger. It's worth unpacking. And if the entry point is Severus Snape with locks, then so be it. Let's have that conversation.
And, you know, I feel like that happened when Hermione in First Child was cast. Yeah, there are these kind of weird ways that, like, have you never been to, like, a Shakespeare play where they cast people who look, like, different from what Shakespeare's actors would have been like? And, like, they're actually women playing women's parts. And, like what kind of...
imagine
like,
a world.
When you are casting, you have some freedom. Like, that's the art form, and it can bring something new and interesting, you know, when you do cross-casting. And I think there's all kinds of interesting things that can come out. And there's a... It's weird to be so inflexible, I guess, I think about things like that. But I was thinking about what you said, like with millennials who always have something that, you know, all along the way, and that yeah. there's a kind of you can develop strong opinions about this. And,
yeah.
you know, some of our listeners have heard our producer, Lori Beckoff, millennial Lori Beckoff on the podcast, and she has super strong opinions, you know, yeah. about especially new media coming out.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a great starting point for conversations of all kinds.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah. I think it does a great job, and it offers us a lot of perspectives, because I think I study race, and one of the facets of the wizarding world is that race is almost non-existent as a concept, as a construct.
Right.
It just doesn't exist in the same way as we understand it. And I think that that's part of the trick of what we're witnessing now with this kind of dialogue surrounding the casting of Severus Snape, because we live in a racialized society. And so it's difficult for us to view a society that is in many ways deracialized without our own racialization in mind. And mm-hmm. so part of our struggle and one of the big critiques that people have leveraged is if you make Snape black, then when he's bullied by James and Sirius and the other Marauders, now they look racist.
Yeah.
And I've always said, but they're still bullies. And what you're saying is that being bullies is okay. Being racist bullies, that's where we have to draw the line. And that feels like a really kind of charged thing to think about. And I've pushed people on it. I'm like, so you're saying, I want to be clear, that if you would be okay with what they did and watching it, if Severus had been cast as a white person. And that, to me, is something that's worth thinking through
yeah.
in a very meaningful way, because mm-hmm. it suggests something, I think, almost more insidious. yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's also making an assumption that you can't complexify the situation any further.
Right. Right.
It's like, why not?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And if this calls attention to the problematic nature with which the Marauders operated, these like two pure blood, wealthy, privileged mm-hmm. dudes who were engaging in this kind of behavior because they could, because they felt they could get away with it, a la Draco Malfoy, mm-hmm. it's not lost on me that we are doing the very thing that we tend to do for boys and men in that position, which is make a ton of excuses for the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And then focus on the what could be or what is, right? Which is what we tend to do for James and Sirius, which is like, well, they got better. And it's like, yeah, but in that moment, they traumatized Severus Snape. We know they did, because he can't let it go and he's taking it out on Harry. And so whether or not it's racially motivated or not seems inconsequential to the fact that what was done to him is bad and it scarred him for the rest of his life.
It encourages us to, I think about it more seriously,
exactly.
then
exactly.
maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm almost looking forward to seeing a Snape where I'm like, oh, I need to consider Snape anew.
You yes, know?
Well, and
me
I
too.
Think I had been reading comments like that had said, you know, it's going to invite people to have to really think about him in a different way. And I think it's true, because I think the movies were very particular about sanitizing Snape. And a lot of his more insidious, sinister behaviors. Yeah.
And Alan Rickman.
Exactly.
You just love Alan Rickman and
right.
his voice and all of that.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of the, you know, Snape-philia came from Rickman's
1,000%.
Portrayal.
Oh, yeah.
And to, like, give that a different cast, I think, is kind of, yeah, worth experiencing.
It's a redeal.
Yeah.
It's a shuffle and redeal.
And yeah. I love it because Snape is my least favorite character. In the entire series. I can't do it. And
despite
whenever,
your Slytherin status.
It's true. But, you know, I like to lean, I lean more into the, like, the Lucius Malfoy of it all versus the Snape. I think, and whenever I bring up Snape and whenever I'm critical of Snape, people, they're like, oh, I forgot about that. I'm like, yeah, because you've been Alan Rickman-fied. You,
mm-hmm.
you were, like, he got you. And
mm-hmm.
and they left out so many things. And so you walk away thinking Snape is this, like, and I'm like, y'all, he was a messed up man who did a decent thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah, but like, and not as many decent things as maybe
no.
he could have done.
Yeah. We have to ask ourselves, what kind of person tells their boss, kill the baby and her husband, but keep her for me. We've got to unpack that. We've got to think through that particular logic and ask ourselves what kind of person does that.
Yeah. And then it's so hateful to little Harry, you know, he can't get over. And he's the adult. And Harry's 11.
And it's Harry. It's Hermione. It's Neville. It's,
oh,
you
Neville.
Know,
right. It's,
and so, yeah, I mean.
Yeah. So, Julian, one of the things that I love about your podcast is the character studies. And you really go deep into the characters to really, I think I can see the political psychology part of what you're interested in. Like, what makes them tick and why are they doing what they're doing within the social system in which they're operating?
Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about, that you did the podcast as a way to give people a little glimpse into the academic, the critical thinking part of Harry Potter. But I'm interested also in, like, does it influence the class? And, like, what have you found in doing the podcast itself?
The podcast has altered a lot of the way that I think through things, namely because of these surveys. So I, like, run a survey for each character with probably 6 or 7 questions. And I walk into class sometimes with these, depending on kind of where we're at. So I love bringing in the perspectives from people write essays, because there's a space where they get to have these, like, open-ended responses, and people will write full-on essays. I did like a 3-part series on Dumbledore, and I probably had like 4 or 5 people who wrote like 10 pages.
Wow. I love that. In the age of AI.
I know. You're like, not, I was just going to say, you're not checking it for AI.
No.
But it's like, from the heart.
They know where we're going, and so they know when we'll get to a place. And so some people have been like just saving, because I've done it in order. So we did Pure Bloods first, and then now we're in Half Bloods, and then we'll do Muggleborns. People have already started writing their Hermione one, knowing it's coming. But I find that having those perspectives from many people from different walks of life, from who all, you know, have these really cool perspectives on characters or are interrogating their own, you know, thoughts on them, really help me then go to class and say, okay, what do you all think about this? And how can we, leverage some of the psychology of the space to think more deeply about some of the decisions that are made in the text? Context always matters. I think there's a world in which we can think about some of these characters and we think about them outside of like time and space. And what I try to do in the podcast is really think like, how can we incorporate the realities of what the wizarding world offers in this moment, right? How can we think about the Weasleys as this pure blood family who is not averse to or immune to having some pretty supremacist adjacent belief structures that aren't great? And how do we reconcile that when we juxtapose them to the Malfoys, and how much are we willing to forgive them? And like, there's a way that I think is really important and meaningful. And so I try to bring some of that in to the classroom for the purposes of allowing us to have a little bit more depth than maybe the text itself allows for us to have.
You know, because you're looking at characters, and as you say, you're not looking at them outside of their context. And there is a good world building that's happening over all the books. And so you can then like really explore what is psychologically possible given the environment that they're in and the way that they've grown up. And that seems like such a like an intelligent, empathetic way just to understand human beings, you know, and apply that like even outside the world of Harry Potter. So sounds like it's good modeling of a way to think about people.
I get a lot of pushback on the surveys because they're all very binary. It's like, you know, yes, no, don't know. And people are like, what about the nuance? And I'm like, yeah, but at the end of the day, one, I do survey methodology for work. So I'm like, I know that there are better ways to ask these questions. However, I also know that when push comes to shove, most of us aren't engaging in nuance until we're forced to. So if I give you a yes or no question, you have the answer more often than not. You want nuance to justify your answer. And that's different. And that's a different necessity for nuance than you believe a thing. Tell me what you believe. And then there's an open-ended response for you to provide all the nuance in the world. But there's a way in which like very few of us are living in shades of gray when it comes to our perspectives on people. And I want that knee-jerk reaction first. And then you can give me the nuance stuff later. And I love that. And so people don't always love me for that, but I personally love it. Yeah. And the first question is always, is X character a good person? Oh. And that really gets them, because they just, you know, they have to start thinking about, well, how do we understand what a good person is? And how do we, I'm like, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, do that work.
So, Julian, we hear that you are working on a book project.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. If I had to make a textbook for my class, that is what this is. I kind of built out some of the broader, more structural thinking about the world. And the goal of the book is really to kind of help us unpack structural inequality by virtue of using what we see and experience in the Harry Potter text as a way to kind of see what society tends to keep invisible and make it visible. And so we run the gamut. We talk about, we start off by talking about, you know, the big structures, the, you know, magical versus non-magical, pure blood hierarchies, and then magical versus creature hierarchies. And then we talk about wands. I mean, then we talk about, you know, the patriarchy and thinking through, you know, how do we understand queer people in Harry Potter, and which is chronically straight, and where can we find queerness in this text? And so we kind of run the gamut in thinking about different societal structures that exist within the magical world and try to deconstruct them a little bit and draw those parallels from the books to our own world so that we can kind of hopefully see those structures a little bit easier and a little bit better in our own world. And so that's what the book is trying to accomplish. As a person who's only written academic books and academic articles, the idea that like my brain is good enough is crazy, y'all. I'm telling you, it is such a wild ride to just be able to write my words and be like, those are my thoughts. And
yeah, you don't have the data set.
Yeah. And I
can tell you use data sets in your
exactly,
research.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, I don't have the data set. And it is my expertise that I'm leaning on, which is also cool and disconcerting because it's like, I don't always get everything right. And also, people love saying that we're wrong. And so it's probably going to be great for book sales in the end because people are going to be looking for things to correct. And I'm like, yeah. So sometimes I leave low-hanging fruit on the podcast. I'll like say something wrong just to get people engaging in conversation because they love to correct me.
See if they're paying attention.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So let me ask you this as a follow-up question, Julian. Like, where do you see the convergence between the academic publications, particularly on Black identity in American politics, and what you are talking critically about in terms of the Harry Potter series?
I think my brain is like hardwired to just see structures in general, identity-based ones. And so the work that I do tends to think about the way that context, historical, political, social context informs how Black voters engage in politics. And in that same way, it's like when I think about Harry Potter, I think a lot about the way that structures inform how we see characters behave, right? So I think a lot about Ron in the moment when he finds out that Hagrid is part giant. And he freaks out. And he's like, that's bad. And Harry is like, but he's our friend. And Ron's like, no, I know, but like, it's bad. And it's like, contextually, of course, Ron is freaked out. He has a level of understanding that Harry simply does not have. And so he's acting on behavior that, and an understanding that is so informed by the context in which he grew up. And that is such a human thing. And so when I think about the relationship between kind of what I do within the Harry Potter universe and what I do in the academic space, it's the same work, just in different contexts. It is fascinating sometimes to think about, you know, the way that my worlds interact with one another and intersect with one another. And I just did an episode of Critical Magic Theory for Black History Month where I broke down the five Black characters that we have in the series and thinking about who they are, how we understand them, how we understand race as a concept within the wizarding world, was fascinating to do it because I'd never done anything quite like that before. And but the convergence of those two things, I think, works in my brain because I can kind of see how similar everything is, and that the invocation of magic does not remove the kind of deeply socialized understanding of structural inequality and like the structures that exist within the magical world that define so much of how our favorite characters operate on a day-to-day basis, politically, socially, and in all the interpersonal interactions.
Julian, why is it important to read Harry Potter critically?
Whenever I write something, I always ask myself, what do we stand to lose if I don't write this? And I think that if I were to apply that logic of like, what do we stand to lose by not reading Harry Potter critically? I think that there is a way that we accept a lot of really awful things that we will agree is awful. I think that there is a world where, you know, there's a lot to be said about the author of this text. And I think the reality is that no book is written in a vacuum. With that in mind, that there are so many things in this text that are lovely and beautiful, and there are other things that are also dangerous. And there are ways that we subscribe to very, very, very antiquated patriarchal ideas. We don't interrogate what racelessness actually means in space. We don't always identify class politics in a way that might be necessary. And we are currently living all of those things. And we also aren't engaging in a deeper thinking about it. And so I think that reading Harry Potter critically gives us the tools to be able to really see what is also in our own world without the guilt and the shame and the self-deprecation and all of those things. And so for me, you know, again, I'll say like loving something doesn't mean we can't be critical of it. And that includes Harry Potter, that includes ourselves, that includes the world that we live in. And so that, you know, the invitation to simply escape into a magical world is so alluring, and I get it. But I also think that by doing that without thinking deeply about it, we don't always recognize what it is that we're internalizing and then how we are taking that thing that we've internalized and externalizing it. And so the critical thinking is to help guide that particular process so that we don't externalize things we didn't mean to externalize.
That is so great. And the series deals so, so fundamentally with the interior and the exterior and the flow between them. I think that's fantastic. I just also want to say we've just had this amazing, you know, critical conversation, critical and also sometimes, you know, sharing our loves about the series.
Yeah.
And we didn't bring up that author except one time.
Yeah.
One time. I just love it when that happens.
Yeah. There's a world where that can exist. And I think I tell people all the time, I'm like, these books were written by someone who wrote what they know. And what I love about Harry Potter, because I often get people say, well, why don't you just do all of this for another text? And I think that the unique thing about Harry Potter is that, especially in the post Harry Potter era, a lot of your young adult fantasies are all intentional about highlighting structural inequality, like systems of oppression. Like it's in there, right? Like Hunger Games, Percy Jackson, like all of these books, they all have built in, which then makes it easier for us to create distance because we're like, well, the Hunger Games, you know, Katniss is, you know, dealing with rebellion, and that doesn't feel very much like our own world. But I think that Harry Potter is so close to us because it's so close to us. And in that way, it makes it worth having to navigate the internalized complexities of how do you deal with problematic aspects of the world, its creator. And I think that I often say Voldemort was a symptom of pure blood supremacy. And the reason why he was able to rise up again was because we didn't call a spade a spade. We all thought it was just him. It becomes incumbent upon us to recognize that it's more than just a person. And that we're talking about systems that allow those people to rise up, to become prominent, to get the power, to get the esteem, to get. And so that the only way to really undo their power is to recognize and undo the systems that allow them to progress to the places that they're in. And Harry Potter gives us the tools to do that.
And especially because, as you say, like, just like with us, you were talking about how invisible some of these things are mm-hmm. to us. And when in the way that it's written, it's invisible in the the books. Also, it's just kind of reflexive and unconscious mm-hmm. in contrast to some of these other works you're describing, that it gives us this good opportunity, as you say, to try out those critical skills, to see what is maybe not explicitly
Absolutely.
Put out there.
Yeah.
How great. I love that. And I feel like we've come right back around to your, you know, your the motto of your podcast, be critical, stay magical.
Stay magical. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Julian.
Oh my gosh, thank you. This was a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
Our closing quote today is from the Dumbledore who speaks to Harry at King's Cross Station in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. That which Voldemort does not value, he takes no trouble to comprehend, of house elves and children's tales, of love, loyalty, and innocence, Voldemort knows and understands nothing. Nothing. That they all have a power beyond his own, a power beyond the reach of any magic, is a truth he has never grasped. Until next time, class dismissed. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.